IQ skill number two. This is where you need to understand decision-making and objection psychology. You need to understand how your audience really thinks to get into their brain. Now, I've mentioned this already, and as you know, we all use persuasion in one way or another every single day. Understanding human nature is essential to maximizing your greatest persuasion potential. Great persuaders instinctively sense and know what other people are thinking and feeling. Imagine if you could get inside your audience's mind. How do they really feel about you? Wouldn't it help immensely if you knew the questions and concerns brewing in their minds? What if you knew their key motivators, their true feelings? Are they telling the truth? Are they lying to you? This sixth sense takes time to develop. Even the most seasoned persuader needs to take a second look at the skill. Why? On average, less than 12% of persuaders have mastered, used, or even understand its importance. They tend to guess and assume what everyone needs and wants. They might be right part of the time, but of course that means they're wrong most of the time. Why do we do what we do? Why do people do the opposite of what's best for them? Great persuaders can find patterns in human nature and customize their ability to persuade accordingly. Human behavior can be predictable. There are certain triggers or knee-jerk reactions we all have. Great persuaders understand both the decision-making process and consumer psychology. When you go to buy shampoo, there are so many options that you have to develop shortcuts in your decision-making process. Do you decide based on color, smell, recommendation, price, or even ingredients? Typically, you follow your instincts instead of weighing all the options. When you ask someone why they bought a BMW, I can guarantee what they answer and the real answers will be two different things. Most persuasion operates below the level of conscious thought. Understanding persuasion involves understanding the human psyche. Such knowledge empowers you to improve your persuasive abilities. A great persuader can help someone see the inconsistency of his present state and what he needs to do to get to his desired state. It magnifies your effectiveness in your relationships, improves your parenting skills, enhances your leadership ability, and helps you sell yourself and your ideas. In short, it maximizes your influence. Be patient with yourself as you work to implement the principles and techniques I outline in this audio. Remember, it's not about getting a few more quick fix gimmicks under your belt. I want you to master these skills to such a degree that they are a natural part of you. I want you to own them. I have noticed great persuaders have the ability to read people and understand their needs, both consciously and subconsciously. Master these skills and people will feel comfortable around you and you will become more persuasive. You will be able to read them and to understand their needs and concerns in a natural, non-threatening way. People won't even sense that you're trying to persuade them. They'll feel like you're just having a natural conversation with someone who is their advocate. It sounds too easy, doesn't it? How is it possible that great persuaders can bypass all the scrutiny, skepticism, cynicism, and distrust that people have today? And how can they do so in a non-aggressive, compassionate manner? This is the secret. Hope you're listening. There are two paths to persuasion, the conscious and the subconscious. Both paths can persuade others to your way of thinking, but each path uses very different means of processing information. With the conscious path, your audience makes a conscious and active effort to understand, define, and process an argument. This type of person is an intellectual decision maker. She just wants the facts, and she doesn't want the warm fuzzies. It is best to go with the flow and not resist this person's desire to cut to the chase. If you try to dress it up, you will annoy, frustrate, and ultimately lose your persuasiveness with her. On the other hand, with the subconscious path, the listener spends little or no time processing the information. They respond more to gut instincts, intuition, and other emotionally based triggers. They just want to feel right about things. They are emotional decision makers. The key to great persuasion is understanding how to balance the use of both logic and emotion. The challenge is we think that our audience thinks we are logical creatures. But most of the time, we don't know why we do what we do. Remember, up to 95% of persuasion influence involves a subconscious trigger. This tendency means that inclinations like, it just feels right, I trust this person, or I don't like this person, are all based on subconscious emotional reactions. This 95% of thought and emotional learning occurs in the unconscious mind without our awareness. What's more, our conscious awareness of reality is a result of neurons in our brain processing all the information around us in unconscious ways. What are some of your subconscious triggers? Smell that triggers childhood memories? Music that increases your adrenaline level? Saying that disgusts you without knowing why? Colors that trigger hunger? Gestures that subconsciously make you tense or uneasy? Someone turns you on by the tone of their voice. The truth is, there is a little bit of both sides, logic and emotion, in all of us. We may be more dominant on one side of the fence than the other, but they are both there. Great persuaders know optimal persuasion appeals to both logic and instinct. For the overwhelming majority of people, emotion is the more powerful motivator. But across the board, the logic component is still critical. Why? Because after the emotional energy of the moment fades, your audience needs something concrete, that would be logic, to fall back on. The elation of the moment is temporary and does you little effect in the long run. The logical component of your approach gives you a way to sustain the momentum long after the persuasive encounter has passed. Emotion inspires us to take action, while logic then justifies those actions. So how does this concept tie into the conscious versus the subconscious path to persuasion? We just acknowledge that for most people, the emotional state has the strongest pull. Some studies conclude that's as high as 90% of our decisions are emotionally based. Even the most analytical and intellectual among us have the emotional pendulum that can swing just far enough to sway us. The key for this type of person is to emphasize logic on the conscious level, but still engage some degree of emotion on the subconscious level. For emotion-oriented individuals, it's just the opposite. Emphasize emotions on the conscious level while engaging some degree of logic on the subconscious level. This is how great persuaders do it. They integrate both sides of the equation to best serve the personality at hand. How do they do this? The Persuasion Institute sought out and researched the input of top persuaders to discover how they achieved this balance and what resources they used. We found that top persuaders made regular use of logic and emotion. Emotional appeals would be testimony, stories, analogies, pictures, and metaphors. Logical appeals could be evidence, statistics, studies, graphs, or even charts. So let's back up a little. Emotions will always rule the day. Benjamin Franklin said, "If you would persuade, you must appeal to interest rather than intellect." I want to show you some examples of when all the sound, logical reasoning in the world was still no match for people's emotions. Did you know that 80% of new products fail or don't even come close to projected forecasts? Large corporations spend billions on focus groups to see if their product or service is viable. Then after the focus groups, participants are sold on the idea. Follow-up shows that only a small minority actually buy the product. Logic made it sound like a good idea in a focus group, but on the actual sales floor, the product or service failed to inspire action. So let's take a look at some specific business flops. Did you ever notice that the video phone concept never really took off? Now, logically, it made a lot of sense to be able to see your loved ones as you talked with them. Emotionally, we're not ready to have people see us in the morning, to have them witness that we're not paying full attention to them, or to have them catch us making faces at them. What about the see-through fridge that was going to save everyone loads of money and energy costs? This was a great idea, a transparent refrigerator door that allowed you to see what you wanted before grabbing it, without having the door hanging open while you mold it over. Logically, that's a no-brainer. It made sense. But emotionally, the see-through refrigerator made us feel a little vulnerable. Who knew the refrigerator could be just as personal as the medicine cabinet? We simply don't want others to see the rotting lettuce we still haven't thrown out, the juice that spilled 3 months ago that we've never wiped up, or the 7 cartons of Ben & Jerry's ice cream that are still inside, even after we proclaim that we're going to lose 20 pounds by the holidays. And what about when Intel introduced a faulty chip? Statistically, it would never matter in 0.00001 of all computers. Logically, consumers should not have worried about it, but emotionally, the chance of having a faulty chip on a new computer was more than they could bear. My all-time favorite is when Coca-Cola launched its new Coke flavor in the 1980s. In the past, Coke was very comfortable at the top of the cola market. Up to that point, Pepsi was not even in the running. Then something strange happened in the 80s, and Coca-Cola saw their market share suddenly decline. During this time, Pepsi had come within 1% of Coca-Cola's market share, even though Coke had spent $100 million more in annual advertising than Pepsi had. Pepsi came out with the Pepsi Challenge, which in head-to-head blind taste tests against Coke showed that consumers preferred Pepsi by 57%. Coca-Cola concluded that it must be because Pepsi was sweeter. So they decided to alter Coke's formula to make it sweeter. Coke tested this new soft drink and found in their own blind taste tests that it consistently beat old Coke. Well, given such a response, it seemed like a sure thing. Well, the rest is history. Consumers went berserk and demanded that Coca-Cola bring back the old flavor, even those who preferred new Coke over old Coke in blind taste tests. CEO Donald Keough said, "There is a twist to this story which will please every humanist and probably keep Harvard professors puzzled for years. The simple fact is that all the time and money and skill poured into consumer research on the new Coca-Cola could not measure or reveal the deep and abiding emotional attachment to the original Coca-Cola felt by so many people." He goes on to say, "The passion for the original Coca-Cola, and that is the word for it, passion, was something that caught us by surprise. It is a wonderful American mystery, a lovely American enigma that you cannot measure any more than you can measure love, pride, or patriotism." The bottom line is that people's emotional attachments run deep, even though they predicted the sweeter tasting cola to hold the day. So let's look at that relationships between emotion and logic. Robert Keith Levitt said, "People don't ask for facts in making up their minds. They would rather have one good soul-satisfying emotion than a dozen facts." Acknowledging up front that there are exceptions to any rule, I want to talk a little bit more about why we are primarily emotion-driven creatures. Why is this so? After all, we do have the most sophisticated reasoning powers of all the animal kingdom. Why do we not use them? Dr. Gregory Nieder estimates that our brains actually run on idle 90 to 95% of the time. Come on, let's face it. Thinking's hard work. It is human nature to conserve cognitive energy. Thinking burns three times as many calories as watching TV. What are the main reasons we choose not to think? Well, first of all, the amount of available information is so overwhelming that we don't attempt to digest any of it. Have you ever heard the saying, "A confused mind says no"? Marketers very deliberately make sure the advertising is clear, direct, and succinct. If there is too much information, or if it takes more than a few seconds to process, the old brain pretty much just reads it as clutter and tunes it out. Another reason we don't take time to think things through is because our decisions simply aren't weighty enough to warrant the effort. Both consciously and subconsciously, we selectively choose what we will acknowledge and what we will ignore. This built-in filtering system has been called selective attention or selective avoidance. Another reason people may ignore certain information is that it goes against what they want to believe. They will tune out conflicting arguments or ignore voices that oppose their ideas or values. Most people will distort information that goes against what they're looking for. Now, on the flip side, when you find agreement, you have your audience's full attention, support, and interest. In one study, 21 students prepared speeches that were written from either a logical or emotional standpoint. The speeches were presented, filmed, and then evaluated by other college students. Interestingly, there was no real consistency in the findings except that the speeches bearing a message that the evaluator agreed with were rated as more rational, even though they were intended to be emotional, while those the evaluator did not agree with were considered to be more emotional, even though they were intended to be logical. It seemed that whether a speech was considered logical or emotional depended on the listener. Researchers also concluded that as a general rule, people seem unable to consistently distinguish between logical and emotional appeals. So whether we realize it or not, we love shortcuts to thinking. Think about a time when you bought an item, but you didn't take much time to research the product or read the latest consumer guide's ratings. We do it all the time. Instead, we might rely on a persuader's advice, or we might just buy the most popular brand, or we might bring a friend along for their opinion. Although we would never admit it, we sometimes even buy an item just because of its color or packaging. We take mental shortcuts in other situations too, not just when we're looking to buy. When we decide if we like someone, we don't run off and do background checks. If we thoroughly considered every single decision, we would constantly be overwhelmed and never get anything done. Businesses are well aware of this fact. They capitalize on the fact that we are busy and preoccupied with other things. Great persuaders use this to their advantage as well. So let's get into the world of objections and concerns. A Chinese proverb says, "If we do not change our direction, we are likely to end up where we are headed." So let's take a look at the way you use these skills. When you become a great persuader, you will view objections differently than most people do. You will even welcome objections and enjoy handling them. Why? You will realize that when people voice objections, it indicates that they are both mentally interested and emotionally involved in whatever it is you are proposing, even if they are skeptical. It may be surprising, but when there are no objections during the persuasion process, the persuader's success rate actually drops dramatically. It's much better to get your objections out in the open and handle them. Great persuaders do not consider objections or audience concerns as opposition. Rather, they view them as part of the persuasion game. Your audience will naturally delay as long as possible the moment of decision, the moment they need to say yes or no. This stalling can be used to your benefit. Dialogue and exchange of ideas can create a long-term follower, client, or customer. Great persuaders may even solve objections before they are voiced. No matter how good you get, objections will be raised, and the truth is that well-handled objections help you persuade. You see, your persuasiveness depends a lot on how you handle objections and concerns, and you can handle them best if you know what the most common objections are. There are thousands of excuses, and you'll hear all of them, but the reality is there are only 7 true obstacles. All excuses and objections can be boiled down to one or more of these 7. The first one, fear of failure. They're thinking, can I do this? Well, they don't have the confidence in their abilities. They might fear what others think if they do not succeed. Number 2, lack of support. Spouse, parents, or friends are unsupportive or even condescending. Number 3, they can't make the commitment. They don't have the time or they have conflicts with existing obligations. Maybe it could be childcare concerns or they need more information. They just can't commit at that time. 4, motivation. The discomfort of the prospect's current situation is not great enough to inspire change, whether it's lose weight, fix it tomorrow, procrastination. Number 5, functional concerns. Will this really work? Will it solve my problem? Is there something better? Will it solve my needs? Number 6, a psychological trigger. It doesn't feel right. Can I trust this person? They're following their instinct. Number 7, financial concerns. They fear that they can't afford it or will be extremely economically stretched by trying to do so. Is it worth the investment? We can call this risk versus reward. Once you understand that all objections stem from one or more of these 7 key areas, you will have a much easier time identifying the root of your audience's discomfort. You will then be able to address it in a professional, caring, and non-threatening way. Many persuaders, and most don't even realize it, show tension, uneasiness, or irritation when someone brings up an objection. Usually, this unrealized persona appears because the objection stirs up the persuader's own insecurities, which could be the fear of failure. The persuader thinks, didn't I go over that already? I'm doing a good job explaining things. Why is this person still not convinced? Why am I bombing this persuasive encounter? Do I sound like an idiot? As understandable as this reaction is, it will only make things worse. Your audience will sense your uneasiness and feel even more uncomfortable. Don't set off more alarm bells than you're already ringing. A calm, natural demeanor opens the door to persuasion and will keep it open in the face of objections. Remember, your audience cannot feel at ease if you don't. They cannot feel relaxed if you aren't. They won't be enthusiastic if you aren't showing enthusiasm yourself. In a very real way, you must create what you want them to feel. Now that we know where objections stem from, let's talk about the optimal time to handle them. You could curb a lot of negative energy if your audience is well qualified in the first place. Now, what do I mean by this? Qualifying a client is when you define on the outset exactly how you're going to spend your time together and what you want to accomplish. You delineate very clearly what you hope to get out of the meeting. In essence, you are qualifying your time together and how it will be spent. Great persuaders are great qualifiers. They don't waste time. Qualification is an excellent approach because it disarms your audience. You've told them exactly what to expect, so they can relax. They won't be caught off guard when you begin asking lots of questions because they understand why you're asking them. The better you become at handling objections, the more persuasive you will be. The key to great persuasion is anticipating all objections, problems, or concerns before you hear them. Great persuaders are always able to accomplish 3 critical objectives during the objection process. The first is that they can distinguish between a real objection and a knee-jerk reaction. Studies show that most objections should not be taken at face value, because there are other issues involved. The second objective is that they listen intently to the entire objection before attempting to solve it. They stay calm. Scientific tests have proven that calmly stated facts are more effective in getting people to change their minds than becoming emotional. Third, great persuaders are never arrogant or condescending. They give their clients room to save face. People will often change their minds and agree with you later if they have room to do so. Another great way to handle objections is to address each of the seven main areas during your presentation before they become big issues in the mind of your audience. That way, you've stopped any potential resistance before it happens. Now, as a result, there aren't many main objections left for your audience to bring up. Studies demonstrate that when objections are handled during the persuasion process, as opposed to the end, 64% of persuaders were successful versus 14% of those who did not finish the deal in the initial encounter. Solving objections before they arise eliminates the tendency many persuaders have of trying to develop rapport, then suddenly shifting gears. Nothing scares your audience off more than experiencing a total shift in your disposition after having getting comfortable with you. Not only is this unnatural, it's creepy. Nothing de-energizes persuasive efforts more than lingering doubts and concerns that remains unresolved in your audience's mind. What about concerns your audience's voices after your presentation? There are three challenges at work in this scenario. First of all, if you find yourself in this situation, you probably did not qualify them sufficiently. Your audience was not properly prepared for how their time with you would be spent. You probably did not gather enough information from them to accurately anticipate their concerns at the earliest stage. You see, great persuaders address concerns while they're still seeds, and they never grow to be rooted plants in your audience's mind. If your audience begins questioning you extensively, you are at the risk of being put on the defensive. Such defending of your position flips your roles and weakens your persuasive stance. Worse, if you do not project even a hint of defensiveness, it can breed more doubt in your audience's mind than the original concern ever did. Let me tell you another fable about a man, a boy, and a donkey. A man and his son were once going with their donkey to the city. As they were walking along by the animal's side, a farmer passed them and said, "You fools, what is a donkey for but to ride on?" Well, so the man put the boy on the donkey, and they went on their way. But soon they passed a group of men. One said, "See the lazy boy? He lets his father walk while he rides the donkey." So the man told his boy to get off, and he got on himself. But they hadn't gone far when they passed three women. One said to the other, "Shame on the lazy man to let his poor son walk." Well, the man wasn't sure what to do. Both he and his son began to ride the donkey together. By this time, they had come to the town, and the townspeople began to holler and point at them. The man stopped and asked what they were yelling at, and the men said, "Aren't you ashamed of yourself for overloading the poor donkey?" The man and the boy got off the pack animal and tried to think what to do. They thought and thought. They cut down a pole, tied the donkey's feet to it, and raised both the pole and the donkey to their shoulders. And then they went along amid all the laughter of all who met them until they came to the bridge. That's when the donkey, getting one of his feet loose, kicked and caused the boy to drop his end of the pole. In the struggle, the donkey accidentally fell over the bridge, and with his feet being tied together, he was drowned. What's the meaning? Try to please everyone, and you will please no one. Learn to understand what people mean, not what they say. So what about pricing, and what about the perception of value? Did you notice on the list of seven potential objections that financial concerns came last? Cost is often the first objection raised, but usually it's not the true reason for rejecting a product or service. Whether you're selling an actual physical product to consumers or an idea to your stubborn teenager, there is always a price involved. It may be financial, emotional, or even a time commitment. Now, I'm going to use the word price in a financial way, but be aware that these principles can be universally applied. I spoke earlier about how we constantly take mental shortcuts. One of the ways we do this is to make comparisons. Instead of taking the time and energy to think everything out, we'll do a quick side-by-side price comparison to see the two competing products stack up. The basic formula your audience is always looking for is, how do I get the most for the least? We all do this. It's human nature. This tendency is critical to keep in mind because as a persuader, you have a lot of control over where your audience sets their benchmarks. So when we look at the cost-value relationship, it's not just about offering the lowest price. Many persuaders have a tendency to fight on price. incorrectly thinking that the lowest price or the most economical bid will always seal the deal. The fact is that price is rarely the main factor behind a buying decision. In fact, 68% of respondents surveyed by the Persuasion Institute admitted that cost was not the deciding factor. And when asked what the most important factors were, less than 10% cited concerns relating to price. The bottom line is that people want to see value. What seems like a lot in one context is nothing in another. Example, $200 is nothing if you're getting $500 value in return. The deal becomes a no-brainer. If you think about it, it doesn't make sense to buy something just because the price is good anyway. What if it's not something desirable, useful, or necessary? Would you buy it just because of the price and no other reason? When you do a good job of helping people see how your product will improve their lives, and you help them from their current situation to their desired situation, price is usually the least of their concerns. Part of this process includes questions and understanding the power of questions. One of the major distinctions between mediocre persuaders and highly successful persuaders is the amount of talking they do and the number of questions they ask. Great persuaders ask 2.7 more questions of their audience than the average persuaders do. Think about it. The average persuader will ask 6 questions. A great persuader will ask 16. As surprising as it may sound, the highly successful persuaders actually do less talking than their not-so-successful colleagues. Why? Top persuaders ask lots of questions and let their audience do the talking. The person asking the questions has control. The person doing all the talking does not. You can control and guide the discussion through questions. As soon as your audience starts grilling you, the tables have turned. You've lost control. Consider the following question and answer scenarios, and you'll see clearly that the individual asking the questions has control. The one doing all the talking does not have the control. Example, an employer interviewing for a job interview, a doctor preparing to diagnose a patient, or even an attorney questioning a witness. Note that in each of these examples, the individual asking the questions is in some sort of authoritative or advisory role. It's not so different when someone comes to you looking for a particular product or service to fit their needs. When you are the interviewer, you glean all the information you need to best guide your audience while still maintaining control over the course the conversation takes. More importantly, this process will allow you to lead them to the final conclusion. Now, this is where your audience jumps on board. And they'll love you for it because they will have done all the talking. Therefore, they will have basically persuaded themselves. You are simply a great listener, a sounding board, and a concerned advocate. Another reason the use of questions is effective is because it helps subdue the natural tendency many persuaders have to talk too much. I talked in an earlier audio about how talking too much is one of the biggest persuasion blunders ever. Nothing kills your persuasive ability more than your inability to stop yakking. Your audience really just came to get a good deal. They didn't come to hear your discourse on the entire product line. They may listen politely, but as you monopolize the conversation, spouting off all kinds of sparkles and pizzazz that have nothing to do with their needs and wants, their minds are wandering to where they're headed next. Then all hope of successful persuasion is lost before you've even asked for it. Information overload just overwhelms your audience. The final reason questions are so useful in the persuasion process is that they engage your audience. Great persuaders stimulate thinking and get us involved. Anytime we hear a question, we instinctively start seeking an answer. It's an automatic response. Even if we don't actually voice the answer, we think about it in our minds. As you apply this principle in your persuasive encounters, always engage your audience with easy questions first, the ones that will be seen as non-threatening. Let general questions precede specific ones. You want your audience to feel comfortable and relaxed, and people are encouraged by answers that they know are right and don't put them on the line, and that don't arouse anxiety. When someone comes looking for advice or input, to buy something or to make a change in their life, it is all in an effort to improve or enhance their existing situation. The core issue is an emotional need. The actual product itself is just a means to an end. It is not, in and of itself, the solution. The emotional satisfaction that the product provides, however, is. This is why asking questions is so critical. It is foolish to make a judgment call about your audience's intentions before you've even had a chance to ask them all the open-ended questions and uncover their hot buttons. The potential buyer wants such and such a product, but why does he or she want it? That information really is what you need to know. Great persuaders know that when someone is evaluating your product or service, they are looking for every reason why they should not purchase. It is a natural defense mechanism. But once they mentally and emotionally commit to an idea that it's the right decision, they start looking for every reason why they should go through with it. When we've invested a lot of time and energy into making a commitment, we want to feel validated in it. So, how does this apply to you as a persuader? Once you've helped your audience see the imbalance between their current state and their desired state, and once they feel motivated to act, you must be swift to get them committed. They'll search for positive reinforcement to feel secure in the new balance they feel. If you don't maintain that momentum, their enthusiasm and energy will wane, doubts about their decisions will creep in, and they'll drift back to their comfortable state. Great persuaders use open-ended questions. These questions allow your audience to express their feelings and concerns. Your audience wants to feel that you have their best interests at heart. Open-ended questions also reveal more information. Questions that can be answered with a simple yes or no don't give you much to go on. Remember the needs and wants of both parties. You need as much information as possible in order to present a win-win situation. What are some great questions we noticed with great persuaders? Where did you start? Or where did you find? What do you think about? Have you ever thought about? And fill in the blanks. How do you feel about? Boom. Open-ended questions. Then you need to understand that moods affect persuasion. Moods affect our thinking, our judgment, and our willingness to say yes. When the person you're trying to persuade is in a good mood, they are more likely to accept your offer. The opposite is also true. If they're not in a good mood, chances are much higher they won't bite. This is a huge advantage to you when it comes to persuasion. Great persuaders create the right mood. Great persuaders actually put people in a happy state. When we are feeling happy, we tend to think happy thoughts and to retrieve happy ideas and experiences from memory. The opposite is true. When we are in a negative mood, we tend to think unhappy thoughts and retrieve negative information from memory. Now, realize the persuader's mood matters also. When persuaders try to cover up a foul mood of their own and put on a happy face, their audience still is able to sense incongruence and tension. If you can bolster the mood, you minimize the likelihood of objections and resistance. How do you influence mood? Well, the most important thing is to make sure you are in a good mood yourself. Even if your audience is in a good mood initially, a bad mood on your part will quickly dampen their spirits. Even if you're trying to hide it. Then your chances of successful persuasion decrease significantly. One particular study demonstrated just how much moods and attitudes of those around us influence our response. Three individuals sat down to a meal together. Two who were in on the study, and one who was unknowingly being evaluated on whether or not his companions altered his opinion of the food. The two conducted themselves in a very disagreeable manner and were unpleasant and contentious. On another occasion, the same individual was brought back to the same place and offered the same food. The only difference was he was given different table companions. This time around, the company was fun, interesting, and enjoyable. How do you think his evaluations of the food differed? You guessed it. The first evaluation was negative, while the second was positive, even though the food itself was identical from one situation to the next. A similar study demonstrated the same idea. A restaurant review contained an equal number of positive and negative statements. Those who read the review while in a good mood evaluated the restaurant more positively than those who read it while in a bad mood. There is evidence across the board that mood is a major factor in persuasion. Even simple mood-boosting methods like eating a good snack or listening to pleasant music have been shown to make people easier to persuade. An interviewer who is in a good mood tends to assign higher ratings to job applicants. Happy moods also increase creativity, which is critical for great persuaders. Consumers who are in a good mood will be more aware of positive qualities in products or experiences they encounter. Teachers and professors who are in good moods tend to give better grades. Parents who are in good moods tend to be more lenient. Just to reinforce a point, let me highlight one more study. The study was conducted in a hotel room that did not have a window or any other means by which the occupant could know what the weather was like. When the guest ordered room service, the server would describe the weather as cold and rainy, or cold and sunny, or warm and rainy, or warm and sunny. How do you think these pleasant or not so pleasant reports affected the amounts of the server's tip? Here's where it gets interesting. It did not seem to make much difference whether it was warm or cold, but when the weather was reported to be sunny versus rainy, tips increased by over 26%. So, how do you ask for your business? What do you do when you get a no? Persuaders can learn a few things from the world of sales. Previously, I talked about that closing skills were not the cure-all for persuasion. But the ability to close is a skill that can be mastered in the right way at the right time. For the most part, persuaders use closing or call-to-action skills incorrectly. This lack of proper implementation creates uneasiness and tension between the persuader and their audience. The idea of closing has long been regarded as applying pressure to get a person to buy. This definition of closing is complete nonsense, and there's no place for it in today's business environment. In fact, if you show me a person who uses aggressive, high-pressure tactics to close sales, I'll show you a person whose ability to persuade is so poor that they have no choice but to resort to such measures to substitute for professional skill. Most of the time, closing is overused and used in the wrong way. When it is used right and sparingly, it can have a powerful effect by helping others make a decision in a timely manner. Most persuaders tend to tense up during the close or the call to action, and then they start to transmit nervousness to their audience. Here's some interesting facts. 20% of the time, the customer initiates the closing process. The other 20% of the time, the persuader starts the process. And a shocking 60% of the time, there was no effort or any attempt to seal a deal or get the business from either party. The key is to use closing in the right way in any aspect of persuasion. This is where you get the yes. It's not time to beat around the bush and hesitate the inevitable. I have noticed with many persuaders that it's like watching them ask a beautiful person for a date. They will do anything, talk about anything, instead of getting right to the point. An interesting note is that 95% of the audiences say that all the small talk and not getting directly to the point during the close or the call to action or when you're going to seal the deal bothers them. Great persuaders know how to read and interpret their audience's buying signals. It's like the gauges in your car. You need to learn how to read the gauges and what they mean. Your audience will tell you when and where to ask for their business. Most persuaders are so captivated with their knowledge of their product or service that they become unable to see any buying signals. When you've mastered the art of persuasion, you can tell by your audience's body language, their question, and their eyes when they're ready to buy. When you miss these signals and shoot past the window of opportunity, your audience's eyes will glaze over and you've lost the ability to persuade. Instead of win-win, you set up a lose-lose situation. In essence, you've talked them right out of the sale. Most research shows that a sale is made after 5 to 7 attempts. We've heard that before. This tendency is why great persuaders have thick skins. They must shake off the rejection and forge ahead with great persistence if they're going to stay on track. Studies show that most persuaders usually give up after 1 or 2 attempts. At that point, they either keep going until the sale is made or they depart as friends. But you would be surprised by how many sales come through because a persuader approaches the prospect just one more time. In light of this tendency, it is more surprising that over 80% of salespeople still don't reapproach their prospects after the initial rejection. When we get the initial no, we just accept it because we assume the person has thought it through and come to an educated conclusion. Well, the truth is, they haven't. People forget or they get distracted. The demands of daily living crowd out even the best intentions. That's why repetition and persistence are worthwhile in sales and persuasion. It's often not that people are putting you off as much as they just haven't taken the time to really sort it through. In the sales industry, even amongst the most seasoned professional, a 20% close rate is considered very successful. The question is, are most people persistent enough to make 10 calls to get 2 winners? Or if they're not yet seasoned in the art of sales and persuasion, are they persistent enough to make 100 calls to get a winner? The answer is no. Most people are not. The first person falls through and they're distraught. That's just not how the game works. So the first part of persistence is just realizing how many no's you have to go through before getting a yes. Great persuaders know and understand consumer mindset and objection psychology. They know the majority of persuasion involves a subconscious trigger. I've identified 12 laws of persuasion that work below the radar. Knowing these laws is your final step in being prepared to take whatever objections may come your way. When you understand these laws, then you will understand human nature. And when you understand human nature, you will then understand why your audience is objecting. You will understand what the real issues are behind the surface level objection, and you will know how to respond in a positive, caring, and helpful way. Grasping these subconscious laws and being able to see how they dictate human behavior will help you become more persuasive. My book, Maximum Influence, is devoted to an in-depth study of these principles, and their mastery is critical to anyone desiring to become a skilled persuader. But to help you understand, let me just give you a brief synopsis of each law. There's the law of dissonance. The law of dissonance states that people naturally act in a manner that is consistent with their beliefs, attitudes, and values. When they behave inconsistently, they feel uncomfortable and adjust their behaviors to regain consistency. When our beliefs, attitudes, and actions mesh, we live harmoniously. When they don't, we feel dissonance at some level. That is, we feel awkward, unsettled, upset, and confused. And we will do practically anything to eliminate or reduce this tension. Basic law of dissonance is you help other people persuade themselves. Then there's a law of obligation, also known as reciprocity. This law states that when others do something for us, we feel a need to return the favor. Returning the favor rids us of obligation created by the initial good deed. In all cultures, the adage, one good turn deserves another, seems to be a universal part of social conditioning. It's part of the ethical code, whether it's taught outright or simply understood. The law of connectivity. We've all met someone who, even in the first few seconds, makes us feel like we've known them for a long time or like we could hang out with them forever. This law states the more we feel connected to, part of, liked by, or attracted to someone, the more persuasive that person becomes. When we feel a bond or a connection with someone, we are more trusting. Then the law of social validation. People seek to watch and know what others are doing to validate what they have done, are doing, or will do. This validation process is often how we decide what behaviors are correct. We consider behavior more correct when we see others doing it. The more people do it, the more correct it becomes. So we often change our behaviors and attitudes so we find ourselves in sync with socially correct behaviors. The law of scarcity. Opportunities are more valuable, desirable, and exciting when availability is limited. We want to own the rare and unique item. And the scarcer it is, the more urgent it is that we own it. When an item's availability is limited or threatened, we crave it even more. Scarcity drives people to action, making us act quickly for fear of missing out on an opportunity. Then there's the law of verbal packaging. The more skillful a person is in their language, the more persuasive they will become. The words we use in the persuasion process have a huge impact on our levels of success. That's because they affect perceptions, attitudes, beliefs, and emotions. Language skills directly relate to earning power. Then there's the law of contrast. Contrasting two different alternatives back-to-back can distort or amplify our perceptions. Generally, if the second item is dramatically different from the first, we tend to see it even as more differently than it actually is. As a persuader, you can use the law of contrast to build value and make price investment a non-issue. The law of expectations. Individuals tend to behave based on how they're expected to perform, whether positively or negatively. When we know that someone expects something from us, we will try to satisfy that expectation in order to gain respect and likability. If used appropriately, this law can inspire people to rise to meet expectations set for them. Law of involvement. The more you physically and mentally involve all five senses of your audience, the more persuasive you will be. As a persuader, you need to engage and involve your audience as much as possible so they'll be motivated and spurred on to action. Law of esteem. All humans want and need praise, recognition, and acceptance. We can never get enough of this feedback because the acceptance and praise are often the sources for one's feelings of personal worth. The law of esteem has the power to change behavior because it makes the recipient feel needed and valued. Law of association. To make order of the world around us, our brains link people, places, and things with life experiences. We associate certain feelings with certain sights, sounds, colors, music, symbols. Colors, music, and symbols. The law of association can be used to invoke positive feelings and thoughts with the desired message. And last but not least, the law of balance. Dale Carnegie said, when dealing with people, remember you're not dealing with creatures of logic, but with creatures of emotion. Creatures bristling with prejudice and motivated by pride and vanity. To be powerfully persuasive, it's crucial that your message have a balance of both logic and emotion. Your presentation will be wider reaching and have a greater impact if you can touch people's minds and hearts. Learn to read people. Learn to understand human nature. Understand the consumer mindset and why and how we make decisions. These are critical factors that will make you successful in the world of persuasion. These are critical skills that all great persuaders possess.